southern kingdom was known as Judah. And after Israel is carried away into captivity by the Assyrians, then Judah will continue alone for about 135 years. And then last couple of lessons, we talked about three deportations under King Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king. And the first world empire that impacted the history of Israel was Assyria, and then you had Babylonia, and then you had Medo-Persia, and then you had Greece, and then you had Rome. And those five world empires will impact the history of Israel and Judah. And that's why they're important to us, and we know a little something about them. And Assyria's connection was, as we have said, they carried Israel away captive. And then when Assyria fell, Babylonia became the world empire. Babylonia will come and take Judah away three different times, three different deportations. And if you have your chart of the kings and the prophets, then you can look at that chart. Hopefully by now you have colored in or somehow marked the 70 years of captivity, and you'll notice that the last four kings of Judah will be at the early days of that 70 years of captivity, and they will, during their reigns, Nebuchadnezzar will come three different times to take away captives. And then the first one, he will carry away Daniel, will be among the captives. The second one will be Ezekiel, will be carried away, and that'll provide the backdrop for their prophecies. And then the third time that Nebuchadnezzar comes back, and he doesn't want to come back at all, but because they rebelled and refused to pay the tribute that they're supposed to, then he keeps coming back. And the third time that he makes that long trip, he decides this is the last time. And so he completely annihilates the city, he burns it, tears down the walls, burns all of the major buildings, and pulls them down. The temple is destroyed, the city walls are destroyed, and so you have 70 years where Jerusalem lies in ruins. And so now 70 years pass. Jeremiah is back in the homeland, having some real difficult times because he will be forced to go to Egypt against his will. On occasion, you can read about Jeremiah. He has a long period of time when he prophesies. Ezekiel will spend all of his time in captivity with the captives. And that'll provide the backdrop for Ezekiel's prophecies. And then after 70 years have passed from the first deportation, then another change in world empires has taken place. Babylonia will come to an end. And then the next will be the Medes and the Persians. And as I have mentioned before, the Babylonians had a policy of deportation, which was very effective. And taking a people that they had conquered, then they would take the bulk of the people, particularly the educated people and the leaders of the people, and they would transport them to other places, and he just kind of mixed and matched. And he would take other places that they had conquered and bring people from there and settle them in the homes that he had taken others away from. And so for several generations, that will effectively keep down any uprising. We've discussed what it would be like if that happened here and all of a sudden 80% of the people in the Houston area, or in the United States actually, were taken to some other country, various countries, and people from various other countries around the world were brought in and set in those houses that had been vacated, then you don't speak the same language, you don't have the same God, you don't have anything in common at all. You don't trust one another, you can't communicate. And so it's really an effective policy that they had to keep down rebellion. And so at least three or four generations would have to pass before they would ever be concerned about any kind of rebellion and people getting organized enough that they could form any kind of rebellion. And so when Babylonia falls and the Medes and the Persians come into power, they have exactly the opposite. They're the good guys. And they were received as liberators in most of the places where they came. In fact, elevated again under the Medes and the Persians. And it will be under the Medes and the Persians that he'll be cast, Daniel will be cast into the lion's den. So he was at least 80 plus years old whenever he was cast into the lion's den. And that kind of puts a different picture that we, most of us, have had in our mind about Daniel being thrown into the lion's den. He was an elderly man when that took place. And now those 70 years have passed, the Medes and the Persians are in control. We're in the book of Ezra now. And we've said before, and let me reiterate to you, that when you start reading in the book of Genesis and you start reading the story, then by the time you get to Nehemiah, by the time that you have read Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, Ezra, and Nehemiah, you have read the Old Testament, the story of the Old Testament. That's where the history comes to an end. And everything else in your Old Testament fits over the top of what you have just read, particularly the prophets fitting over the latter part of the in the divided kingdom. But it's just like an overlay. And that history that is recorded in Kings and Chronicles provides the backdrop for each one of the prophets. And as we have gone through the story, I've tried to pull out at least one or two verses out of most of the prophets and try to set them in a context to show you that you can understand the prophets if you will take a little time to get this story and this history down. And then take that chart of kings and prophets and utilize that. And by the way, everything that all these charts and so forth have been, Corey's uploaded those to our website, and you can download and print them if you'd like to. I didn't want to labor everybody down and burden everybody down with a lot of printed material because some of you want it and some of you don't want it. But if you would like it, then you can download it and you can print that any of these charts that we have here. And so, Ezra chapter 1, verse 1. If you will, put our slide up. This one has been up a time or two. And this will be, we had three deportations under the Babylonians. And just like we had three deportations, we're going to have three returns. And Babylon will fall. And very shortly after that, we'll have our first return. And it is recorded in the first six chapters of Ezra. And it is led by a fellow by the name of Zerubbabel. Now, the story is set in what is now the Persian Empire. It was the Babylonian Empire, now it's the Persian Empire, because Babylon has fallen. And let's start reading a little bit together here in Ezra chapter 1, verse 1 through 4. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah, the Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia, to make a proclamation throughout his realm and to put in writing, and then he gives the written proclamation that he has. If you'd like to make a little note, I can't prove this, but I have a very strong suspicion that one of the ways, if not the primary way, that God, in fact, moved the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia, to liberate the Jews is something that happened 150 years before he was born. And if you go back to Isaiah chapter 45, verse 1 through 7, the Lord had called Cyrus by name 150 years before he had been born. And he told what he was going to do. And so it is my suspicion that the prophet Jeremiah came to Cyrus and he said, I've got something I want you to read. And he gave him a document that he could prove was 150 years old, written by a prophet 150 years ago. And Cyrus read a 150-year-old prophecy that called him by name and told what he was going to do. Now, would that stir your heart? Sure, sure. Particularly if it could be proved that that document was 150 years old. And it called him by name and told what was going to happen. And so, in fact, that probably did move his heart to do that. And he said, the first part of the proclamation, this is what Cyrus, king of Persia, says: The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me Now, this is a pagan king that's writing this. This is not today. This is not a Christian. He's not a Jew. He's a pagan king. And yet, he says, the Lord God of heaven has moved me to build a temple for him in Jerusalem, in Judah. Anyone among his people of you, may his God be with him. Let him go up to Jerusalem and Judah and build a temple of the Lord, the God of Israel, the God who is in Jerusalem. And the people of any place where survivors may now be living are to provide them with silver, gold, goods, livestock, freewill offerings for the temple of God in Jerusalem. And then it tells about the first group that will go. And they're led by Zerubbabel. When they get there, their purpose is to rebuild the temple. And when they get there, they begin in chapter 3, rebuilding the temple. And Cyrus will issue a decree. In chapter 4, you're going to have some opposition to the building of the temple. And it will come from the people who have been left in the land. They will be called Samaritans. And the Samaritans come and want to have a part initially in helping rebuild, but the Jews who return refuse to allow them to have part in rebuilding the temple, and later refuse to allow them to have any part in rebuilding the city walls. They say, you don't have any claim on this. And the Samaritans were those people who had been left in the promised land, in Canaan, whenever the Assyrians had taken Israel away, the Babylonians had taken Judah away, and the Bible says only the very poorest sort of the people were left in the land to tend to the vines and grow crops and so forth. So that's the very few people that were left, and during that interim period of time of 70 plus years, then you're talking about essentially three generations, roughly, that will grow up and get married. Well, who are they going to marry? The number one criteria of who you're going to marry is who you know. You can't marry somebody you don't know. And so they married the ones that they knew, and it was the people there. And so they had a problem with intermarriage, those few Jews that were left there. And they became, as it were, half-breeds. And later in history, Josephus will, of course, with probably some prejudice, say the Samaritans claimed to be Jews when it was convenient, and they claimed not to be Jews when it was convenient. And so they had Jewish blood, but yet they had intermarried with others, and that's going to create a problem for these people who come back. And so the rebuilding begins in chapter 3. The opposition from the Samaritans comes, and they will cause the rebuilding to stop. In fact, basically a slab is poured. And it comes to an end. The people have a big celebration. It's great, you know. And then because of the opposition, they stop. And for 15 years, there's nothing but a slab out there. And they stop building. And it's really interesting right here. Let's take another little side trip right here. And hold your finger there in Ezra. And go over to Haggai. If you're looking at your chart of your kings and prophets, you will see that Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi are the last three prophets. And so let's go and look at Haggai, and let's read, but we've got a context for it now. Let's begin reading in chapter 1. In the second year of King Darius, on the first day of the sixth month. Now, King Darius was the king of what? Persia, right? The first day of the sixth month. It's in his second year. So, this is pretty new in the reign of Persia. The word of the Lord came through the prophet Haggai to Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest. This is what the Lord Almighty says. Here's the message. These people say, the time is not yet come for the Lord's house to be built. Now, remember, there's a slab there. And they quit. 15 years passed. And the people are trying to justify the fact that they did not finish building the temple. And so they say, say, the Lord said, this is what the people are saying. It wasn't time to build the temple. Then the word of the Lord came through the prophet Haggai. Is it time for you yourself to be living in your paneled houses while this house remains a ruin? Now this is what the Lord Almighty said. Give careful thought to your ways. You planted much, but have harvested little. You eat, but you never have enough. You drink, you never have your fill. You put on clothes, but you're not warm. You earn wages only to put them in a purse with holes in it. What's the problem here? He says, I want you to think. Back off a little bit and think. You are not prospering. You're putting lots of effort out, and you're getting very little back in return. Do you think you might can figure out why this is happening? This is what the Lord Almighty says. I'm back in verse 7. Give careful thought to your ways. Go up to the mountains and bring down timber and build a house so that I may take pleasure in it and be honored, says the Lord. You expected much, but see, it turned out to be little. What you brought home, I blew away. Why? Declares the Lord Almighty. Because of my house, which remains a ruin, while each of you is busy with his own house. Therefore, because of you, the heavens have withheld their dew and the earth its crops. I call for a drought on the fields and the mountains, on the grain, the new wine, the oil, and whatever the ground produces, on men and cattle and the labor of your hands. Then Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and the whole remnant of the people obeyed the voice of the Lord their God, the message of the prophet Haggai, because the Lord their God had sent him, and the people feared the Lord. Then Haggai, the Lord's messenger, gave this message of the Lord to the people. I am with you, declares the Lord. So the Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, the spirit of Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest, the spirit of the whole remnant of the people. They came and began to work on the house of the Lord Almighty, their God. And on the 24th day of the sixth month in the second year of King Darius. And so, you get some history. This is what's taking place here. This is what makes the study of the Old Testament interesting. Whenever you can understand the history of what's going on, then you can understand the prophets. And then when you get the picture of the fact that they started building the temple, they quit for 15 years, they didn't work on it anymore, and then the prophet Haggai comes along and he says, haven't you got this thing figured out yet? You've been working hard and not getting anything in return. Whatever you bring home, the Lord said, I blow on it, blow it away. You bring some money home, you put it in the bag's got holes in it. He says, you're working and you're not prospering. And there's a reason why. Because you've built your own houses and you've taken care of yourself, and you say, the time is not yet right to finish the temple of the Lord. He said, the time's right. Get up there, get the timber, and finish that house for me that you started. And so, and also, while you're right there, look at Zechariah. You're probably, Bible may be open to that page already. Zechariah 1. In the eighth month of the second year of Darius. Now hold your finger right there and go back to Ezra 1, or 2, excuse me, to Haggai 1:1, and you'll see that they're only a couple months apart right here. The eighth month of the second year of Darius, the word of the Lord came to prophet Zechariah, son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo. The Lord was very angry with your forefathers. Therefore, tell the people, this is what the Lord Almighty says. Return to me, declares the Lord Almighty, and I'll return to you. Do not be like your forefathers, to whom the earlier prophets proclaimed. This is what the Lord Almighty says. Turn from your evil ways and your evil practices. But they wouldn't listen or pay attention to me, declares the Lord. Where are your forefathers now? And the prophets, do they live forever? But did not my words and my decrees, which I commanded my servants and prophets, overtake your forefathers? And then it says, then they repented and said, the Lord Almighty has done to us what our ways and practices deserve, just as he determined to do. And so Zechariah is going to be addressing the spiritual problem. Haggai is going to be addressing the physical problem. Of them not taking care of the temple and rebuilding the temple. Now back to Ezra. Ezra chapter 6. You have another decree from a Persian king, Darius. Cyrus is gone. Darius now issues a decree. And associates carried it out with diligence. So the elders of the Jews continued to build and prosper under the preaching of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah, the descendant of Iddo. They finished building the temple according to the command of the God of Israel and the decrees of Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes, king of Persia. And so, the temple was completed 15 plus years after it was begun. And that's the first return. And then you have a second return, and that will be under Ezra. And Ezra, this story will be told in chapter 7 through 10. Of Ezra. Chapters 1 through 6 is the first return. The second return is Ezra 7 through 10. And Ezra, the way that you can remember, a little hook again, and this I guess comes from my King James background. For some reason, whenever I think of Ezra, the King James says he was a ready scribe of the law. And for some reason that stuck with me over the years. And so I know what his job was. His job was to restore the law. Zerubbabel's job was to rebuild the temple. Ezra's job is going to be restore the law. And one of the problems that he's going to address in chapters 7 is going to be the problem of this intermarriage. And he's going to get the people together. They're going to come up with a solution themselves. They're going to say, okay, we've got to put these foreign wives away. They're going to take a vow to do that. It's going to tell two or three men who were opposed to that. But by and large, they put those wives away. But you're going to find out that that didn't completely get the job done. And so that's the second return. Ezra will address the problems, the spiritual problems that result. And then the third return is going to be under Nehemiah. And that's told in the book of Nehemiah. Most of us know what the book of Nehemiah is about. Nehemiah came back to rebuild the city walls. We've got a temple that's been rebuilt now. We have at least some portion of the law that has been restored, and a priesthood has been restored. But now we've got a problem. The city still lies in ruins. There's a temple there, but it is surrounded by rubble. And the city walls have not, there's been no attempt to rebuild them. And so Nehemiah begins in Nehemiah chapter 1, the words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah, in the month of Kislev, the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa. And Susa, by the way, is the capital of Persia. Hananiah, one of my brothers, came from Judah and with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that survived the exile and also about Jerusalem. So he's in Persia. Some people have come to visit from Jerusalem, and he inquires about how are things back home. They said to me, verse 3, those who survived the exile are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down. Its gates have been burned with fire. When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven, and then he gives his prayer. Then you pick up in chapter 2, it says, in the month of Nisan, the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. He is the cupbearer to the king. You know a little of the history there. He's a really important guy. The king has to really trust him because one of the ways that kings were assassinated was to poison their food or poison their drink. And so they always had somebody to taste the food or taste the drink before they did. And they had to trust that person. And so he was a trusted servant of the king. And he was serving wine to the king. And he says, his footnote is, I had not been sad in his presence before. By the way, that wasn't allowed. You didn't come into the presence of the king with a downcast face. You were happy and cheerful and smiling when you came into the king's presence. So the king asked me, what is your face? Why does your face look so sad? Are you ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart. And then Nehemiah says, I was very much afraid because he had noticed that I was sad. And that very potentially meant my head was about to be lifted off of my body. But I said to the king, may the king live forever. Now that's the way you start every conversation with the king. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? And the king said, what is it you want? And I prayed to the God of heaven. That was a quick prayer. And I answered the king, if it pleases the king and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city of Judah where my fathers are buried so that I can rebuild it. The king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked me, how long will your journey take and when will you be back? It pleased the king to send me, so I said, time. He will make him the governor of Judah, and he will give him everything that he needs, command the people in that part of his empire to provide the things that they need for the rebuilding of the city walls. Now, the story of Nehemiah is the story of lots of problems that they encountered once they got there. The history of some of the opposition is in chapter 2, verse 19 and 20, and it names two people specifically who were Samaritans who did everything that they could to stop the city walls from being rebuilt. You see, because there's bad blood between the Jews and their neighbors, it goes all the way back to the time when God brought them to the promised land, and they drove those people out of the land. And so there's been a claim going back and forth that the land belonged to those who originally had it, and then the Jews said, no, it's our land because our God gave it to us. And you can take possession of the land that your God gives you, and so we're only taking possession of the land that our God has given us. And then in chapter 6, verse 15, the wall is finally completed. You remember the story of Nehemiah. Really, really deep story of leadership. Some really vital principles of leadership can be gleaned from the book of Nehemiah about how to deal with opposition both inside and outside. Incredible book. The wall was finally completed, and Nehemiah will say, because the people had a mind to work. They worked day and night until they completed the city walls. Now, the Old Testament is coming to a close. As you draw a picture of what the scene is, and by the way, he's going to address two problems at the end of Nehemiah. One of them is that the Jews who live in the city once they've got the walls completed, they're conducting business on the Sabbath day. They're still buying and selling and trading on the Sabbath day, and he puts a stop to that. And there are some of the traders from other places who come for a couple of weeks and camp out outside the city walls on the Sabbath just in case they can get in. He goes out and tells them, if you don't get out of here, I'm going to take you out. Don't come back here on the Sabbath day anymore. Now, Nehemiah, he's a tough guy. And when you see how he handles the problems, he didn't pull any punches. And then the next problem he had, interestingly, was guess what? There was still a problem with the intermarriage people around them, and some of the children spoke half the language of Ashdod and half the Hebrew language. And so this problem of intermarriage, and Nehemiah takes a little bit more direct route. It says that he grabs some of them by their beard and he jerks the hair out of their beard while he's talking to them. He's pretty rough, but he tells them what the problem is, and he says, what you're going to do is you're going to put those foreign wives away. And I'll stop right there. At least with the story, I want to draw one more picture as I close, but we're going to pick up right there because I want to draw a little piece of history to begin the next lesson from this story about Nehemiah having them put their foreign wives away. There's going to be one person that's going to be involved here that is going to be a really, really strong influence. He's going to refuse to put his wife away. And there are going to be some things that happen, and we'll look at this shortly the next time. It's going to set the stage for a lot of Jewish history down the line, including John chapter 4. But we'll look at that next time. I want to draw a picture to kind of close this out. Now, after the three returns from captivity, generation that had not seen Solomon's temple was really, really excited because this was the first that they had seen of that temple. So it says that the sound of crying and the sound of rejoicing was mingled together whenever they celebrated this new temple. But there is a temple on the site. The city walls have been completed and the gates are set up. But the city itself is still lying in rubble, all between the temple site on the hill and the wall that's been restored are still blackened rocks and stones that used to be houses and used to be businesses and so forth. And the people who have returned are living in the outlying areas because it was a lot easier to get 20 acres and a mule and be out here and have you a little farm and you could, you know, you could raise some food and so forth. And nobody wanted to live in the city itself because it was such a terrible mess. And you had to clean the stones up because they had been left in disrepair and they had been burned and so forth. And so nobody wanted to live in the city. And so at the close of the Old Testament, they cast lots. And they say every certain person, every seventh person, I forgot what it was, is going to go agrees before we draw lots. Going to agree to go back into the city and rebuild a house in the city. And so that's where the Old Testament comes to an end. The temple is there. The walls are standing. And now there are people who are going back in to rebuild the city and repopulate the city. The Old Testament's come to a close. There's going to be a 400-year period of time when the prophets fall silent. And then John the Baptist will come on the scene in the New Testament. And so, as we look at this story, it's just one continuous story, beautiful story, of God's providence, of God's control, of God allowing His people and causing His people to suffer punishment whenever they leave and disobey. I believe that the message of Daniel, it is the God of heaven who sets up kings and who brings down kingdoms, is still true. I believe God's still working in the affairs of I believe that when history is written and we are able to look back one day from heaven and see our time in a perspective and see it in a more objective perspective, we're going to see some of these very simple type stories of God saying, haven't you put it together yet? Don't you understand why I blessed you as a nation and you turned away from me and this happened and this happened and this happened? I'm not a prophet. I'm not telling you why things happen. But I am saying that God has been consistent throughout history. And as far as I know, He's still consistent. And I don't believe He's withdrawn Himself up into heaven and has nothing to do with the affairs of men. I believe He does. And I believe righteousness exalts the nation. And while I'm concerned about our nation, I'm more concerned about the Lord's church. And that we have a sense of family. And we have a sense of purpose and a sense of mission. It's always been a remnant. It's always been the few who are faithful causes God to bless a nation and a people. And so I have a vested interest in this family. Because as you go, so go I. As your family goes, so goes my family. We're in this thing together. And I'm glad to be in it. And I'm trying to learn to trust God more in my life. You are too. And as we read this story and we see this, it helps us make right decisions in our life. Because we're not disjointed from the God of history. He still is the same God yesterday, today, and forever. And so we have something to give us a basis for making right decisions. Whatever's happening in your life right now, it's going to pass. It's going to be history. Whatever it is, good, bad, or indifferent, it's going to pass. And one day we're all going to stand before a righteous God to be judged. And right now, it's really important that we make right decisions, individually and collectively. That we walk by faith, not by sight. It's important that we do that. That we trust God enough to entrust Him with our life. And so if tonight, as you look back over the story, His Let those principles